You know the words of Jesus, "Come unto me, all ye that are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." What do these words mean in their inner depth? In our simple state, we have a sort of a childlike trust that if we give our allegiance to this being called Jesus and put before Jesus all our troubles, difficulties, sorrows, and so on and so on, He will carry our burden and we shall have rest. This is the sort of common or garden feel and idea that the Christian world has. Jesus said, "Come unto me." Who is Jesus? A man about whom we make a picture in our minds? We can never go to the reality which was Jesus. Totally impossible. We couldn't have done that even when he was alive and amongst us. Unless and except we were not in need of putting our burdens upon him. Because that meant we were in total communion with him. Therefore we have no burdens to put upon him. But not being in communion and being what we are, there are burdens, there is weariness, there is toil and so forth. We who live after the death of that person called Jesus simply can never be in touch with that living reality in any shape or form. We produce a mental construct, an image, an idol, which we label Jesus. And that mental construct bears the impress of all our mental conditioning, our psychological conditioning, of our own darkness, ignorance, also of what capacity we have for vision and so forth. It bears the impress of that. And when one says Jesus, just as when one says Krishna or Buddha or whatever, whoever it is, you see, it is our mental construct in our own brains, in the immediate now, that we are referring to. Now this is something which is extremely important. We must realize that first and foremost, because once we really see that this is a mental construct to which I am trying to go, it's quite useless. If I can open my mind and heart through purification, through emptying the mind, then a transcendent reality is enabled to come into being within oneself. And this is the only thing that can be there. Not the historical Jesus or whatever he achieved or realized or anything at all. But this can come into our being then. Now there are certain ways in which we can see this in depth. You may recall I mentioned the sixth Sephira, Tifereth, associated symbolically with this region of the body, between the two shoulders, round about the heart, so to say, Tifereth, the sixth Sephira, Tifereth, which stands for beauty, harmony, justice, which is the mediator between mercy and stern judgment. This Sephira represents the Son of God, the Son of the Father. It represents the Christ consciousness. And the essential characteristic, perhaps the outstanding characteristic of the Christ consciousness as exemplified through Jesus, was the consciousness which is represented in the words, "Thy will, not mine, be done." You see? Now, what is the significance of that? Here is a being then, who is completely unselfed. He is no longer drawing anything to himself for self's sake. There is no such thing as I, the self, in that ordinary sense which characterizes all human beings in the world. It is an unselfed state. Therefore, the communication between that Christ consciousness and the transcendent consciousness itself, the Father in heaven, is complete and unobstructed all the time. He speaks the word of truth as the Father himself speaks it, so to say. Now, that is the me that is referred to. You and I have to go to that now. Here is the paradox. If we can go to that, if we are capable of being there, we have no toil and problems and so forth. The words as they stand may perhaps be regarded this way. By trying to come unto me, through your labor, your burdens, your toil, your sorrows, you will find rest by the time you have arrived there. Because this toil, this burden, this labor attaches to us only insofar as we are worldly. Otherwise it isn't there. There is activity. There is action, which is pure action for the Holy One. Just as there is a lot of busyness, fussiness for the unholy one. The unholy one regards all this fussiness and busyness as action. But this is precisely what the scriptures call inaction. It is activity which obstructs life. The simplicity, the purity, the rhythm of life produces disharmony. So we get weary with it all. But the action, which is the action of the Holy One, has none of this, because nothing unessential enters into the life of the Holy One. So we must try and deeply sense the significance of this. Come unto me. Enter into this mode of awareness, the Christ consciousness, in which there is only the will of transcendence and not my will working. Because the will of transcendence is a desireless thing. My will is of necessity, invariably a thing of desire, limited desire. It isn't the whole. Because I, being a particular creature, cannot compass the whole. The whole compasses me, but not the other way around. What can I do then? I can't compass the whole, but through self-naughting, making myself nothing, letting myself be totally empty, that transcendent whole can move in and out through me unhindered. This is what you and I can do. This is one of the supreme purposes of our existence in the world, on this planet. This is one of the great purposes. Because you see, in manifestation, there is this evolutionary process. That is to say, a developmental process, a process of growth. Whatsoever comes into being comes purposefully in order to become something richer, stranger, more wonderful, with two special characteristics perhaps: greater refinement, greater sensitivity. You can work out the implications of that not only in the organic world, the world of living creatures and human beings and so forth, but in the mechanical world. The more perfect your machine, your instrument, the more refined, the more sensitive it is. You take a thermometer or a galvanometer or anything, you see, they become more and more sensitive, and they record more and more perfectly. Look at the extraordinary extent to which science has gone, when it is now capable of taking, that is to say, producing the equivalent of 200 million photographs per second in succession. It's just unimaginable. The mind completely boggles at it. You can't hold 200 million per second in your mind. Look at the fractions of time. We go right up into 1,000 millionth of a second. And things like that. And the same with the measure of distance. The refinement, the subtlety, the sensitivity has gone to extraordinary lengths. Now that happens in the mechanical world, in the world of matter, in the world of scientific experiment and so on. And it is the same sort of thing which marks growth, isn't it? We call that progress in science, to do this sort of thing. It's the same with us. In the time process, in the becoming process, there is this evolutionary or developmental trend. And that is a trend which especially characterizes all that is living, what we commonly call living, the organic world, and particularly man. So it is this growth of sensitivity and refinement which is involved in it all. And this takes place in the realm of consciousness too. I remember talking to a doctor of philosophy in 1932. We were actually on the same ship going back to India. And in the course of conversation, I brought out this phrase: the evolution of consciousness. And it absolutely electrified him. And he said, I wish those who were my tutors in Harvard and Columbia could have heard that phrase. Evolution of consciousness. Which simply means that this organism, this psychophysical organism, with increasing refinement and increasing sensitivity, is able to be aware of things which are undreamt of in the philosophy of ordinary mortals. Now, the Christ consciousness is one such expression of this perfected sensitivity. And we have to pay the greatest attention to some of the outstanding features. One which we have already mentioned: there is no personal will, which means there is no personal desire involved. What we call personal desire is now a shape in the mind of the Holy One, of that shapeless, formless, transcendent will. So in that sense, there is a personal desire, if you like. And associated with this freedom from all personal desire, there is freedom in so many other aspects. Consider what brings about our struggles in the world, basically. Personal desire. I want to do this. I want to achieve this. I want to become this, that, or the other. Personal desire. And in order to become this, that, or the other, which I want, I can do it only in terms of competition, of conflict with another. Now, supposing my will as such, my desire is completely out of it, who does the doing, or what does the doing? The totality. And when the totality, or if you like to use the other word, transcendence, does the doing, there is no anxiety in me, the individual. There is no concern about failure or success, progress or regress. That doesn't mean that one becomes indifferent. On the very contrary, because the mind is pure and free, because the sensitivity and the refinement is working at its highest pitch, the most perfect action possible through oneself comes into being. Now you see, come unto me and I will give you rest. There is action in the condition of perfect restfulness. But this is the real meaning of a holiday, a holy day. Action which is devoid of anxiety, which is devoid of the squandering of energy, which is devoid of ill consequence, and so forth. And it is full of rest. It is full of peace. The peace which is due to inward poise. A poise which is a dynamic, rhythmic state of being and functioning. And in this peace, action goes on unhindered in perfection all the time. One has to be in touch, personal touch, at some time or other of one's life, with people who have this kind of poise inside them. And it is simply fantastic to observe what they are capable of doing. In 1960, towards the end of 60, when I went to India on that pilgrimage, starting with Ceylon and going right up into northern India, I met a few such people. Their day would start at 4 o'clock in the morning, and their tireless activity right up till about midnight, or even 1 o'clock, 3 hours of sleep, and they were fresh as daisies the next day. And no noisy exuberance to indicate their freshness and their joy in life. And whatsoever they did, whatsoever they touched in their daily work, was done with an ease and a perfection which was astounding. It's quite extraordinary. I can assure you, it took the life out of me to spend a few days in their company. I was absolutely worn out, tired. Mind you, admittedly, they were in their 30s and 40s, but some were in their 80s, and I mistook every one of them for being not more than about 50. See, there is the living evidence that this is so. This is not a sort of a fanciful idea. You see the living proof in people who are alive today and who are like that and carry on. And quite meticulous as regards time, place, appointments, work done, everything, just done to perfection. I had the illusion that such qualities were typical of Western Europe and did not exist in India. I was mistaken. They do exist in India too. So, come unto me. Come to this state, which is free of desire, in which the mind is completely empty of all that obstructs truth, reality, in which the heart is open and free, unfettered by attachments, by aversions. And when the mind is empty, it is also free of all criteria, of all judgments, of all condemnations, of all appraisals and approvals. Because when it is free of those things, pure intelligence comes to life and functions for the first time, not till then. Till then, it is the conditioned intellect which is at work with all these with all these criteria and standards. Because criteria and standards arise by comparison of one limited thing with another limited thing. And the two things are kept separate in consciousness. And because of that separation, the sense of wholeness is never there. And if the sense of wholeness is never there, the sense of transcendence and the capacity for unity, the state of unity with that transcendence, is absent. See, these are very difficult things to understand. Because this sort of thing totally negates what we are accustomed to. We wonder, but how can this be? Everything would stop and there'd be chaos in the world. Well, the world got along very well for 5,000 million years without us. Then we came on the scene and introduced all these things. And now the world still turns round fairly reliably, but in some ways the soul of the world, the soul of the earth, cries unto its Lord for release, for a redeemer. You know, it's extraordinarily significant that you find similar symbolic representations of this fact in the great religions. In Zarathustrian writings, in the Gathas, for instance, they begin by saying that the soul of the earth, Geush Urva, the soul of the ox, literally, Geush, you see, ox. But the ox is the symbol for the world. Those who are keen on astrology will tell you that the sign of Taurus is responsible, or rather associated with, the creation of the material universe. The ox, you see, all right. So, the soul of the earth cries unto her Lord, send me a deliverer, one with a strong and a mighty arm, who will destroy all the evildoers who oppress me with wrath, with violence, with rapine, with murder, and so forth. How do you pronounce that word? R-A-P-I-N-E. What's the correct pronunciation? I always forget to look. R-A-P-I-N. Rapine or rapine? Rapine. Rapine sounds right, I think. Thank you. You see, the soul of the earth cries like that. In the form of an Geush Urva, remember, the soul of the ox. If you look at the Bhagavata Purana, you've got an almost identical form. Then the earth, in the form of a cow, with tears rolling down her cheeks, you see, prays unto the Lord, that this is what is being done on my body by human beings today. Send me a deliverer. In the case of the Avastha, the Gathas, Zarathustra is the deliverer who ultimately comes. In the case of the Hindu Bhagavata Purana, it is Sri Krishna who comes. See, you get in the Old Testament the idea of a Redeemer in terms of the Messiah. But note carefully, every time the prayer of the earth is couched in terms of sending someone with a strong arm who will destroy the evildoer. And the transcendent answer is never one with the strong arm. It is the perfected Holy One. And in each case there is disappointment and rejection by the earth at the decision of the Lord to send this rather than that, the strong arm. And then the earth accepts afterwards. There is very deep significance in this. You look at our own lives. Aren't we like the Red Queen in Alice? Off with his head. For everyone who opposes my will. The strong arm comes into play when my will is opposed. But the Holy One, who is the fulfiller of the transcendent will, never brandishes steel or handles gold. Extremely significant. Jesus is portrayed, conventionally portrayed by the great artists, by so many of the great artists anyway, as meek and mild. Why? What is the meaning of meek? The meek one was the tamed and trained one. You know, in Palestine in those days, they took an ass, or a colt, young colt, and they tamed him and trained him to obey man's will. That process of taming and training is described by the word meek. And right up till medieval times, the verb in the English language was meeked. A person who is meeked means that he is tamed and trained. Now, if he's tamed and trained, it means that the personal will exists no more, but that creature or person is completely in tune with the will of whoever is Lord and Master. So you see, Jesus is portrayed as meek and mild. And he comes to redeem the lost sheep of Israel. He says openly, I do not come to convert the others. It's only the lost sheep of Israel I am concerned with. What is the significance of the sheep of Israel? Israel means he who has striven with God, with Elohim, actually. And he wins in the striving with Elohim. Not against Elohim, but with Elohim. He wins. And then from that time onwards, his name is changed from Jacob, was it, to Israel. Who was it who strove with the Lord? Jacob, yes. And his name henceforth was Israel. He who had striven with the Lord. And then the other meaning of Israel is he who rules with God. Now, those who are like that, in their ranks too, you will find failures cropping up. Jesus comes to reclaim them, the lost sheep of Israel. And it is specifically for such people that the words of Jesus have such tremendous meaning. Come unto me, all ye that toil and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Any one of us in the world who is really concerned with allowing this trend of life to come to fulfillment in us as human beings. Any one of us who is like that is a religious being. And for any one of us, those words of Jesus apply. If you look at the Buddhist formulation, you see how the Buddha presents nirvana as the perfect peace, perfect rest. It is the equivalent of the Sabbath, is it not? And the Sabbath, which is called the seventh day, really contains within itself all the other 6 days, the totality. It doesn't mean a stoppage of work, but it is the state of fulfillment where transcendent action now is totally unhindered by the turmoil and differentiation which may have been represented by the other 6 days. Now there is perfection. The unbroken holiness of transcendent being is there. And that is the state of rest, of peace, of perfect action. And that is nirvana. Brood upon these things. And see what emerges in your own mind, in your own heart and consciousness. Because remember that the Judeo-Christian tradition is the stuff out of which the very cells of your body are made. You are born in this tradition. And one cannot deny one's natural heritage. Who can deny the physical fact that that man was his father and this woman was his mother? Absolutely impossible. No one can deny that. It's a fact of nature for all time, so to say. So you see, it is the same with the psyche. We cannot throw aside the heritage into which we are born. We can relate it to others. We can include them. We can put out feelers and make greater and more and more beautiful relationships. But we cannot deny that with which we start. Do look deeply into these things and the meanings of so many otherwise puzzling, perplexing things will become clear. Particularly, for instance, the meaning of karma. It will become clear. And then your toiling and sorrowing and moiling and so forth will not be there.